everybody. I'm Al Barton, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Billy and the Ridge Beakers group for inviting us up here. It's always a pleasure to, you know, be invited to, you know, attend a meeting. And I've known Billy over the years, and it's just been, you know, it's been fun. And we were up here not long ago for the conference, and we enjoyed seeing everybody, and it was just so much fun. So it's just a pleasure to be here. So thanks to a higher power and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and good sponsorship, my sobriety date is January 19th, 1979, and for that I'm grateful. I'm a member of good standing of the Midtown Salem group in Salem, Virginia, and we meet on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and if you're ever in Salem or the Roanoke area, come see us, and we have a newcomers meeting at 6:30, and the regular meetings are at 8 o'clock, so we'd love to see anybody, you know, and also, you know, the you know, we were talking about coming down. There's a meeting that Fred and I go to occasionally on Saturday. It's not our home group, but we go there. And Gloria, who spoke here, I think, recently, you know, I know she would love to see a contingent. So come on down. We'll have a bite deep. We'll go over there for that. So I always try and say yes. I came into the program in Louisville, and I was taught to say yes if at all possible. And I try and do that. And I like what Dr. Bob has to say in his story, where he offered four reasons why he tried to do that same thing. And he said, first, it was a sense of duty. And second, it was a pleasure. And third, it was a way to repay the guys that were here before us. And also, fourth, it's a little insurance against the slip. And I like that, and I think it's, you know, it's good enough for Bob. It's certainly good enough for me, and I always try and do that. So the book tells me that I'm supposed to share, you know, in a general way, what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like now, and I'll try and do that. I was born in Virginia, believe it or not, my accent notwithstanding. My mother's side of the family are all from the Roanoke area, and my father's side of the family are all from the Tidewater area. But Dad was with his company, transferred him to Cincinnati, so I grew up there, and that's why I talk funny. And but it was always, Virginia was always a lot of fun. It was, I associated with summers, and whether we were visiting my mother's side of the family in Roanoke or down at the beach with Dad's side of the family, it was always a lot of fun. And what brought us back is my mom got sick with Alzheimer's a few years ago, and we came back really to take care of that, and we just fell in love with Virginia all over again. So we're here, you know, and we're, you know, we've been here now 14, going on 15, it'd be 15 years in about 6 months. So we feel like we've never left. But I grew up in Cincinnati, and for those of you that know that area, it's a German city, and up there, beer is food. And I suppose probably the first, you know, alcohol I had was probably a sip of beer, and it's no big deal. And there were a lot of entertaining in our home. Vendors were coming in from all over the country, and both parents entertained a lot. There were always people coming in. It was a whirlwind of activity. But there was no active alcoholism in our family. It skips a generation once in a while. I've subsequent to getting in the program, I've learned that on my mother's side of the family, as our Irish Catholic, there's tons of evidence of people that had an alcohol problem. But also on my dad's side of the family, you know, they have an uncle that was in Washington for all those years that, you know, had a problem. And so I think this is all interesting chit-chat, how I got it, the disease of alcoholism, but I can't use that as an excuse. I think I have the disease of alcoholism, and it's up to me to do something about it. So growing up, I was a pretty normal kid in Cincinnati. I did all the things little kids do, swim, play football, baseball. You know, school was easy for me. I didn't have to really work that hard at it. And you'll hear patterns in my story just the same as you hear patterns in lots of people's stories in AA. And the first one, the first pattern is things are going pretty well, and then something happens, and it's not so good. And in this case, my dad was in the meat end of the business, and he had grown up around Smithfield kind of hams and always wanted to get in the country ham business. And they don't come available very often because they're typically family businesses, but in this case, there was a medical doctor in Louisville that built a brand-new facility, and he died. He had a heart attack and dropped dead before they ever cured the first ham. And so Dad had heard about that through some friends of his in Louisville, and he left early retired, and our family moved to Louisville, and he bought that ham business down there with another meat guy. And you would think if you didn't know better, you know, you look at a map, you'd say, well, they're 108 miles apart and two big river towns, they'd be similar, you know, that nothing could be further from the truth. Cincinnati's a northern city, relates more to a Chicago or a Detroit. Louisville's a very gracious southern city, emphasis on pedigree and granddaddy and all that. And Dad was too busy to worry about that, but I was a little Fonzie that got plunked in the middle of that Louisville society, and I dressed funny, and I talked funny, and all the things I was good at, those kids didn't do down there, and it was an awkward time. And in high school, I morphed and changed into what I thought they talked and looked like, and they couldn't tell me from a native. And but I was ill at ease, and I discovered in high school that I had an enormous capacity for alcohol, and I misunderstood it. Like, I misunderstood a lot of things about this disease. I thought it was a macho thing, and I was sort of the designated driver before there was, you know, such a thing. And it didn't do for me what it did for the other kids. I didn't get sick. It just made me funny, you know, and I was relaxed, and you know, it was great. I couldn't wait to get back into Cincinnati, so I went to school there as soon as possible. And they had an 18-year beer drinking age in those days, and I'd be, lying if I didn't say it was fun in those days. It was largely confined to the weekends, and didn't affect school. I was, you know, I didn't really have that much trouble with school. And it was fun, and it became a big part of my social life, and there were really no problems at all. Then the next pattern in my life, and I've talked to a number of people about this, I'm a sprinter. I don't do anything very well for the long haul, but I'm capable of bursts of energy, and I can get a lot of things done. And in this case, I decided enough fooling around, enough kidding around, and I was going to get serious about school. And I somehow convinced this dean that I was going to turn over a new leaf, and I went to graduate school, and I got a scholarship. And I took full-time day and full-time night, and I taught. And I don't think I could do it now. And it was a quarter system, and it was just about to drive me loony, you know, because every time you turn around, there's a test or a paper or something. But I got through, and I got my master's in 1 year, which is pretty quick, and still maintained a 3.6 ACUM to keep the scholarship. And at the same time, I lucked into a terrific job in Cincinnati. The company was in a New York-based company, but the training was in Cincinnati, of all places, so I didn't have to go anywhere. And then I married my college sweetheart, and it was just like the cosmic tumblers clicked in. It was just great. Everything worked. And people that knew me thought, well, you got the world by the ears. And I suppose I probably did, you know, at that point in time. But then things start to happen. And I finished that training program, and then I was with a big company, a Fortune 4 company, if you follow my drift. And they like to move you about every hour and a half, you know, just to keep you churned up. And I was trying to get, after this training program, everybody in those days was trying to get out on the West Coast, and there was a job in California that I was trying to get. And it was nothing magic about the job in California. It's just that you want to get a little equity in California, and then when you move back east, you know, you're great, you're all set. So that's what I was trying to do. And I had a mentor in that program, and he pointed out to me that, they have the identical job opening in Louisville. And I said, for God's sake, I've tried so hard to get out. It's like Tale of Two Cities. I've been trying to get out of that town. Why would I willingly go back? And he said, well, it's a problem zone. It's a nepotistic zone. It's a headquarters. And you see all kinds of, Machiavellian stuff going on there. And it's a great learning experience. And, it'd be perfect for you. So against my better judgment, I wound up going back to Louisville. I don't know, and I've thought about this a lot, I don't know that I consciously changed what I drank or how much I drank. I think the only difference is I started up to that point had been largely on the weekends, now became during the week. And all I know is that something changed. I know what it is now, and in hindsight, looking back, I had crossed the line into active alcoholism. Because sometimes I could drink and I'd be fine. Other times I would black out, I would experience blackouts, I couldn't remember what happened, and I reached a point where I couldn't predict with any certainty what would happen once I took that first drink. I may be okay, or you may have to go to Mexico and bring me back if you can find me. You know, I just couldn't predict what was going to happen, and it was causing a little bit of a problem in trying to explain it to people. And my attitude was just leave me alone, I was just working really hard, and I'll be fine, just leave me alone, I don't want to fool with you, And I became more and more isolated, and I just obsessed and poured myself into that job. And in rapid order, in the next year or so, I picked up 2 DUIs. And in Kentucky in those days, now they're actually more severe than Virginia is. But in those days, as long as it wasn't Louisville, Lexington, Northern Kentucky, if it was a rural area, a quick check to the county judge and an apology, and a lot of times the paperwork would go away, and that's precisely what happened. Both times I was in St. Louis, and I was coming back on a Friday, and I was driving slow in the right lane, and I got picked up, you know. So I got off the hook on both of them. I've often thought if it happened today, that would not occur, you know, and I've thought that if, you know, maybe if they had not let me off the hook, maybe I might have found the doors of AA sooner. But that's just speculation. It didn't work that way. And not long after that, my wife came in and she announced that she wanted a divorce. I didn't see it coming. It stunned me. But I refused to. I was so willful and so hard-headed. I refused to admit any part I played in that. I can remember telling friends, well, she stuck with me through thick, and we'll see who made the right decision. And I just refused to even participate in that. But privately, I was just stunned. I was wounded. I didn't understand it. You know, I do now, you know, but I didn't then. But free of anybody that knew or cared how much I was drinking, then I was off to the races. And then began the third pattern, and that's this geographic, you know, excursion that we all, some of us take. And after about another year, the boss came in one day and he said, good news. He said, we've talked about it, and we've got a little more money. We've got a new job for it. We're going to transfer you to Nashville. And I said, Nashville? I said, I'm a Yankee. I can't handle 24-hour day hee-haw. I said, you know, it's crazy. And I don't know anybody down there. And he said, well, we're not asking you. We've talked about it. We just think it'd be good, you know, give you a fresh start. And, you know, you'll like it down there, you know. Okay. So I went down there, and I just knew one guy in the office. And I went in the first weekend. I met this guy who was with RCA Records, and he drank just like I did. This guy's a talent scout for RCA, and he's the greatest guy to run around with because you can't buy a drink with this guy. You know, everybody wants to be his friend because he's a kingmaker, you know. And for some reason, he and I hit it off, and we started, you know, I had a whole, every membership card in Nashville. My wallet was thick with all these clubs and everything. And I loved it. It was just great. It was like Vegas with music, and it was just crazy, you know. So I, you know, instead of being morose about it, I thought, "Wow, this is great." But I didn't work that hard, and it was in such a competitive environment that if you didn't, it began to show up. So after about a year and a half, I thought, "Well, enough hee-haw, enough kidding around. I got to get serious." So I left the company, and I got a job as a national sales manager for a Fortune, you know, 100 company in Chicago, and made a lot more money. And I, you know, and I thought, well, this, you know, I'll just get serious about it. Going to New York, Detroit, and Chicago, essentially the eastern half of the country, and worked for a retired brigadier general in the Marine Corps, and a little different, you know, scenario than what I had been in, you know, before. But the money was great, and you know, I started off, and it was fine for a little while, and then pretty soon my drinking caught up with me. And the remarkable thing in hindsight is the fact that I was able to stay there as long as I did. And it was only because it was such a big company that I couldn't even mess it up. And I was surrounded with a bunch of really great people. But it wasn't certainly because of anything I did. And my drinking was progressing. It was getting worse. And after about the ninth time you're drunk in Boston, it's just another hotel room. It doesn't matter. You know, it wouldn't have mattered where I was or what I was doing. And but I was living that hell that we all go through, or many of us go through, I'll put it that way. And I didn't know what, you know, to expect. The last big move I had was I was being recruited by a guy for a job in Denver. And I thought, well, enough New York, enough Detroit, you know, Chicago, enough, you know, Denver, Rocky Mountain, Coors, you know, it's healthy, you know. So I'll go out there. So I took that job, but by that time, the progression of this disease had really sunk in, and I'd tell Fred, you know, I'll see you for breakfast tomorrow morning, and he'll believe me and show up for breakfast, and I may or may not even remember seeing Fred, you know, and it had reached that point with my drinking, and that, you can't function. And along the way, I had gotten exposed to AA in St. Louis. I used to go down there on business once a month, and the branch manager was a dear friend of mine, and we would go to dinner, and he would eat, and I would drink. And swizzle sticks were piled up in front of me one night at dinner, and I asked him, I said, Tag, don't you want a drink? And he smiled and said, no, thanks. He said, I used to drink just like you do. Thank God I don't have to do that anymore. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't try and 12-step me. He didn't evangelize. He just made a quiet statement, but it made an impression on me. And I remembered that. And when I got in trouble out in Denver, I went to my first meeting. And it was a suburban meeting, and I wasn't ready. AA is great. The problem was me. I went there for all the wrong reasons, and I'm sure it was to let's make a deal. you know, that look at what a good boy I am, and then I'll get out of whatever trouble I was in. But I went there, and all these guys were, they could not have been any nicer. They were all giving me their names and numbers, but I looked around, and I was in my 20s, and I didn't see anybody that looked quite like me, and I thought, okay, I got it. Now, if I'm an old guy, and I got a problem with alcohol, now I know where to go. I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, which was nonsense. It was just nuts, but that's the way I used to think. And about this time, my father called, and he and I had talked about going into business many times, and he said that his partner had announced the week before that he wanted to get out and play golf, take it easy, and he said, if you're sincere about it, now's the time to do it. And I thought, yeah, okay, you know, that's the next chapter. That's what's going to happen. So I said, sure. And I knew that he was too perceptive, too sharp, that if I didn't try and clean up my act, I was going to be in trouble. He'd spot it in a heartbeat, and the whole deal would be off, you know. So the only time I ever tried to control my drinking or stop drinking, but I stopped. I white-knuckled it and cleaned everything up, and he came out, and we visited, and I came back to Louisville and, you know, put this deal together to get the partner out. And at the first board, and it had been almost 11 months as we liquidated the hams that holiday season. We repaid the note, and the smoke cleared and everything, and I was in, the partner was out, and we didn't have any debt. And we had our first little board of directors meeting in January, and I had not had anything to drink, I think, as best I recall, it was about 11 months. And this board, this banker, friend of Dad's, had been a banker in Louisville for 20 to 39 years. And he said, I've seen a lot of deals over the years, but he said, I've never seen anything as sweet as this. He said, if you've done this in a few months, imagine how good you're going to do in a few years. And I thought, well, yeah, you know, I'm a sprinter. That's what I do. I make things happen in a hurry. But to me, it sounded awfully like, much like permission to drink. Because that's what I did. I'd work really hard, and then we'll celebrate. We'll have a party to celebrate, you know, whatever it is we're trying to do. So I started drinking again, and in a matter of just weeks, it was worse than Denver, you know. And Louisville is one of eight meccas for AA around the country, a very strong AA, very step-oriented AA. And I was welcome to keep coming back, but they were not going to let me twist AA into a pretzel, you know. So I try, and then it was like Groundhog Day, the in and out, in and out, in and out. And I, you know, if you had hooked me up to the lie that I'm not here, I see people now all over the country. You know, they say, well, I came to AA and shazam, I got sober and lived happily ever after. You know, that was not the case with me. I'm envious of people that do that, but that was not my experience. And finally, I just didn't know, you know, I was at wit's end. I didn't know what to do. And if you had hooked me up to the lie detector, probably I would have said, well, you know, it's a great program, but it's not for me, you know. And I would have believed it. And in hindsight, looking back on it, there's nothing wrong with AA. Again, it was me. It was just, I was just not teachable. I was not ready. And even though I should have been there years before, you know, I just, I couldn't see it. I couldn't understand. I couldn't comprehend, you know, what I was even about at that point. And it was an interesting way that I finally got into AA. I took a little New Year's Eve party, and I was supposed to go to visit some friends. And I think I left Louisville on the 30th of December. My sobriety date again is January 19th, if that tells you anything. And there was a missing little two-week period in there that I don't know what happened. I came back. I had no money. I had books of matches from New York City in my pocket, and no money, and I couldn't remember what happened to the people I left with. And, you know, and my dad had developed cancer, and he was at the oncologist that day, and I was dying. You know, I just wanted to get out of there and go back. I lived in Louisville, and I wanted to go back and get a drink. And phone rang, and we were right next to a convent, you know, and a little sister's of charity, and there was this nun that was a friend of Dad's, and she was on the phone, and she wanted to talk to me. And I thought, I don't want to talk to her, you know, and she was Dad's friend, and I was always very polite to her, but she was Dad's buddy. And I thought, what in the world does she want with me, you know? And then I thought through it, and I thought, well, she was a nurse by training and from Georgetown, and I thought that what she wanted to do was explain my dad's disease and prepare me for the inevitable progression of that cancer. So I thought, well, I'll go over and just see her for a few minutes and get this over with and get out of here and head to Louisville, you know. So at 5 o'clock I went over, and she was waiting on me in the little parlor, they call it. And she patted the couch, said, close the door and come over and sit down. Something I want to talk to you about. So I did, and I sat down, and she looked at me, and she said, what I want to talk to you about is to find out when you're going to do something about your drinking. And if she had hit me with a baseball bat, she wouldn't have stunned me more than, I mean, I was not prepared for that. And I'm not outwardly a very emotional person, but I was crying, and I had to admit to her that, you know, I knew all about AA, and I had tried, and it's just not for me and everything. She said, well, follow me. And we walked down the hall. She was a pretty tough lady, and she pointed to this bulletin board with all these little scraps of paper on it. She said, do you know what that is? And I said, it's a bulletin board. She said, yeah, but it's actually more than that. She said, it's a prayer board. And with your permission, I'd like to put you up there anonymously and have the 400 sisters here pray for you. You know, well, what are you going to say? No? You know, I mean, you know. So, you know, I looked at her and I said, well, you know, I'm only half Catholic. You know, my mom's Catholic. You know, she says, it doesn't matter, you know. And she said, now there's one other thing I want you to promise me. And I said, well, sure. And she said, promise me you'll go back and try again. And I said I would. So on the way back, it's about a 45-minute drive, and all I want to do is just go and get in the shower, and you know. But I knew that if I did, I'd have a drink, and I'd never make that meeting. And I diverted, and I got to this meeting way early in Louisville. And this guy who had been very patient with me, and he had the patience of a saint, you know, and trying to deal with me for all that time. And he's there early. He's normally a 7:59 guy that skids into the, you know, the parking lot. But for whatever reason, you know, which, you know, probably divine intervention, he's there early. And I'm blathering on, telling him about my trip and what happened and Sister Sally and blah, blah, blah. And he stopped me and he said, Al, he said, think about it. He said, you don't have to justify yourself to me or explain yourself to me. He said, what's unusual about those of us that have a problem drinking? That's what we do. What's unusual is to find a group of us that share that same problem who have found a way to not drink one day at a time. You go back into that home group and you pick up a white chip and you're going to be more welcome than ever before because you're being honest. And that's precisely what I did, and that's how the miracle began. And he became my sponsor, and he was a tough sponsor. I found out later he was sponsoring 44 guys, very stiff-oriented. And I wound up getting two other guys just for access, just when I needed to get somebody, you know. But he was my primary guy. And he was wonderful with the steps. And so a lot of what I thought I knew about alcohol, if you had asked me right then and there, I had all the answers. I knew everything about drinking and alcoholism and everything. But much of what I knew was wrong. For example, I told you I stopped for 11 months. So I really thought this was a willpower thing. And I don't think I ever verbalized it to anybody, but I always kind of felt in my heart of hearts that I knew it was bad. I didn't have to have anybody tell me, you know, that I was drinking too much or I got in trouble. But I thought that if it got really bad, then I'd do something about it. Well, it got really bad, and I tried, and I couldn't stop, and it scared me. And I didn't rattle easy, you know, and it terrified me because I thought, oh, you know, I'm doomed to an alcoholic death. It was just a spiral, you know. And I didn't know how to break it. I didn't know what to do. And so these guys got a hold of me, and they said in the beginning, just ask in the morning, ask God to keep you sober, and if he did at night, thank you. And I thought, don't you know who I am? I mean, you're talking to me like spiritual kindergarten. But I was scared, and I knew that if I didn't do something differently, I would die, you know. And I didn't want to, so I can remember saying that, and I couldn't get chips. I get white ones, but I couldn't get any progress. And all of a sudden, to my amazement, I started putting together a whole string of sober days, and you know that was the traction that I needed. But they explained to me that this is a progressive fatal disease. My body produces a defective gene that once I ingest ethyl alcohol, it's only partially broken down, and it builds up acetone, and it sets up a craving for more. And it's progressive. As I get older, it gets worse. Never gets better. And it's fatal. And if I don't do something about it, it'll kill me. And that made perfect sense to me. And it's classified as a disease by the American Medical Association, British Medical Association. And all of a sudden, it relieved me of this struggle that I was, you know, wrestling with on willpower. And the second and third step, you know, they said that they pointed out to me that the purpose of this book, when you read it, is not for me to get sober and then me to go out and try and take care of all my problems, which is what I was trying to do all these times that I had come before. And I couldn't do it. I was as powerless, you know, sober as I was when I was drinking. And they said, no, that's not it. The purpose of this program and this book is for me to establish a relationship with a higher power who is going to not only keep me sober, but help me manage my life. And that's a big difference between me doing it versus that relationship. And they said the second and third step, you can really only understand it in the rearview mirror with the help of a very good, you know, sponsor. And it happens for all of us, but each of our stories is a little different. And I'll share one with you that there's a girl in my home group that always wants me to tell this story. It's amazing. I was saving money trying to get a little bit for a down payment, and I got a new job. And I was sitting down with the human resources lady, and she's going through all the stuff, and among other things, she said, oh, by the way, we pay closing costs on your house. And I said, oh, you know, and I'm not one to leave $5,000 on the table, you know, so I said, okay, you know, and she said, do you have a realtor? No. Well, we do, and she hooked me up with the president of Caldwell Banker, and this guy does like $10 million homes, and, you know, and I'm, you know, talking about some dinky little starter home, and I was so embarrassed. But I, for some reason, I decided to get honest with the guy, and I told him that I was in AA. I was like a German Shepherd puppy telling him everything, you know. You know, I'm in AA, and I'm just getting started, and I'm trying to, you know, save money, and I don't have a lot of money and everything. He said, that's fine, everything's fine. He said, I'm going to put my best girl with you, and she'll get you squared away. And he did. And she showed, you know, we found the house, and then they came back, and they said, how about a lender? I didn't, you know, I didn't have one in that state. And they said, well, we do, you know, and so they took me over there, and the girl said, how's your credit? And I said, well, they had ground me to mincemeat in Louisville, you know, with the financial amends, so it's actually pretty good, you know, and she did, you know, the quick check, and she said, that's great, you know, I can pre-qualify you right here. So we went and made the offer, and we had the inspection, and they found a few things, and in that state, the guy who is the inspector can't fix them. So they had to put the money in escrow, and there was a long waiting period. And he said, don't worry. I said, a couple days, I'll get somebody to do it for you. And this guy came over, and he fixed it for about half of what the escrow amount was. And he said, it's too complicated to screw that amount up. Why don't I just paint your house for you, you know, inside and out. Great, you know. So he did. And I was FedEx and stuff back and forth, and I got, you know, I closed, the house closings were taking about 10 or 11 weeks at that point in time, and I think I closed in 3 weeks. And I had been on a business trip out west in California and in Dallas, and I hadn't been to a meeting, and I came back the day the movers arrived. I found the coffee pot, and I found the, you know, the alarm clock, and I said, that's all I need to worry about tonight. I've got to get to a meeting. I called, and there was one right down the street, and I walked in that meeting. There was the realtor. There was his girl, the sales girl. There was the lender. There was the inspector. And there was the guy he had found to fix my stuff. And they all knew I was in AA, but I didn't know any of them were, you know. And that's the second, third step, you know. And it's you know, the hand of God working, you know, doing for me what I can't do for myself. And it happens for all of us again and again and again. But you really need the help of a good sponsor to interpret it, I believe. I got to the house cleaning steps, and I wasn't quite sure about that. I didn't know, and I had been married to this, she was a psychologist, and I kept looking at these three little lists, and I thought, you know, how is that going to help me? I mean, for goodness sakes, you know, it's so, you know, it's just not enough, you know. And of course, I didn't dare tell this mean old sponsor, you know. And I'll tell you, if I get time, I'll tell you a little story about him. I always tell everybody how mean he was, and they say, oh, right, you know, it's selective memory, but, you know, he really was. But for those of you who may be at that point and trying to look at the four step, it's really a lot more to it than meets the eye, you know, and it's comprehensive. It does get it all. And resentments is the first list, and it's a Greek word, sent to feel and resent to feel again. And if I'm mad at Fred, I'll tell Billy, but let me tell you about what Fred did to me 2 years ago, and I'll get all worked up. And I feel those emotions all over again, and Fred's oblivious, so he doesn't even know I'm talking about him. So it doesn't hurt Fred in the least. But the danger is, if I don't process it and control it and, you know, calm down a little bit, it could lead to a drink for me, and then that could be fatal. And that's why they say it's so grave. And the interesting thing, I had a partner, for example, in that business when I came back in the family business, and I was in my 20s. I didn't have that kind of cash, and I needed to get some money. So I went down, and I went to a competitor, a guy that I knew was a little bit older than I was, and I tricked him into investing in the business. And he did, and then I hated him for it. And all he did was just what I asked. But I resented him for it, and I think because he could effortlessly do it and I couldn't, I think is the honest answer. But I basically treated him terribly. He was a minority shareholder. I wouldn't return his calls. I wouldn't share information. I treated him horribly for 5 or 6 years. When Dad got cancer and I was at the worst of my drinking, he went around and tried to, you know, take the business. And when I would tell that story, I had repeated it so many times, each time I would edit out any part that I played in it to where I was as pure as the driven snow, you know. And I was telling a sponsor about this guy and how much I hated him, and he said, well, what'd you do to him? No, not a thing. You know, I'm a lamb. You know, I'm just, not, you know, didn't do anything. What do you mean? And he said, well, that doesn't sound right, you know. And he kept probing, and finally he said, how'd you meet the guy? And then the light went on. It was an epiphany. And I realized that the truism of what happened in every deep-seated resentment I have, that I started it. I went to him, not the other way around. Everything got started with my self-centered behavior and continuing, you know, obnoxious behavior. And it's a miracle the guy didn't shoot me. You know, really. I mean, and all he did was just wait until the end, and then he was just wanting to get even. And I went back and I looked, and the honest answer is that's true in every, you know, deep-seated resentment that I had and to this day have. So it's something that I say or do that sets it in motion. The same thing is true with fear. And I used to joke that if a grizzly bear walked into the meeting tonight, I wouldn't be afraid of him because I was reckless. I was sort of cocky. But I was afraid of the Marine Corps, and I was afraid of judges, and I was afraid of policemen, and I was afraid of the IRS. And if I had any kind of run-in with anybody, then I didn't want anything to do with them again, you know. So I had a lot of fears, and I think for a lot of guys, we have the same kind of fears that women have in the program, but it's harder to express them or identify them. And then the third list is sexual harms or harms that have, you know, done to others. It could be friends or whatever. And I think, you know, in that case, it's not about sex. It's about trophy wives and about, you know, sort of insincere relationships. And the book talks about we are incapable of forming true partnerships with another human being, whether it's a business partnership or a marriage or, you know, a friendship or even family relationships. And I think that's what's so hard to make on the amends side because, you know, by that time a lot of guys that I work with get tired, you know, and they, you know, their inventory is, I'm a selfish pig and I hurt everybody, you know. And then it becomes very, you know, very difficult. Then it's not like you can write a check or simply say, I'm sorry, and then it's all okay. It doesn't work that way. But anyway, I got all that down, and it wasn't pleasant. But I felt like for the first time in my adult life that I was looking honestly at what was going on with me. And then the fifth step I took with this guy, you know, I found out later he had heard over 300 fifth steps. And he was really good at it. And basically, I thought I was so unique and the only person that had ever come to the doors of AA with this particular group of problems. But what he did was he listened patiently and then pretty soon he connected the dots. And it was nothing unique about me. I was a garden variety drunk, but I was repeating the same pattern of character defects. The people and the dates and the locations were changing, but my behavior was the same. And so my magnificence got reduced down to a repeating pattern of about 6 character defects. And it was something comforting just to see that, you know, because I understood, you know, what I was dealing with. And he told me to take 6 or 7 that night. And I had a false start on 8 the next morning, and I thought, well, this is easy. That's a resting step. You know, anyway, everybody knows that. And I don't need his help on it. I'll just run up and, you know, make a list and run up. And, that little company in Denver was headquartered in, you know, that was a division, and the headquarters was in Indianapolis. And I went up to get my bonus that I thought I was supposed to get. And I was going to tell them what a good boy I was and how I was in AA, and they were going to give me a bonus check. And instead, I got shown the back door and kind of a, it's about time you did something about your drinking kind of reaction. And I came back and talked to the sponsor, and he laughed. He thought that was hilarious. And he said, you idiot, you don't know what an amend is. An amend is not about you getting anything. It's about you setting matters right, and it's something that's going to cost you dearly in terms of time or money or both. And he said, now, when you're ready to really start doing this the right way, come see me. You know, and he was mad at me, and so I went to talk. I thought about it, and I went to see him. And he said, "How often do you write your parents?" Write my parents? You know, never. You know, he goes, "Good. I want you to write them a note every week and tell them what you're doing, whatever dumb little thing you're doing." Okay. How often do you call them? randomly. He said, not good. He said, I want you to call and find out when it's good for them, and I want you to call them weekly at that time every week. So I did. And the last year of my dad's life, I made 9 trips to Roanoke. If I was anywhere in the South, I wound up in Roanoke. And the last time I saw him, we sat on the porch, and he had a swing on his porch, and we talked. And he said, you'll never know how much your mother and I used to like to get those notes. It didn't matter what you were doing. He said, we just knew you were okay. And it was a reassuring thing. And we looked forward to those calls. He said, you'll never know. And then he asked me, he said, I have a favor to ask you. And he rarely asked me to do anything. And he said, I want you to promise me that you'll take care of your mother and make sure that it's okay, you know, for her to live in this house as long as it's safe for her to be here. And I said, well, of course. And he said, no, I'm not asking for a quick answer. He said, I mean it. She was a little feisty Irish lady, and it was like getting her to do anything. It was like trying to give a cat a bath, you know. She's, really, willful person. But I did, and little did I realize from that date it would be 17 years until her death. And I was living in New York City, and I got a call from my aunt. She had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and, the aunt told me that it's not something you have to do tomorrow, but at some point, you need to get back to Virginia and take care of your mom. And that's what brought us back, and that's 14 and a half years ago. And we've never, we just fell in love all over again with Virginia. But that was hard in many ways, but it was a very satisfying, amend that these guys had done. And I know nobody, in Madison has financial problems, but I did, when I came in. And they had 2 guys in my home group. That one guy was a chief financial officer, believe it or not, for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and he was a soulless, Italian guy from the Bronx. And there was another guy in the home group that was a skip tracer, from Montreal, Canada, and had been married 12 times. The guy was a character. He was like a pirate, And you could barely understand what he had to say, but he was really clever with money. And my sponsor said, take your bills over there and dump them on Frank's dining room table. And I said, I'm an MBA. I'm supposed to know how to do all that stuff. And they said, we don't care what you are. Bring your bills and dump them. And it was, I did. And they put me on a little tight leash, and we started doing that, and I kept saying, none of the other guys, you're not making them do this, you're just singling me out, this isn't fair, and all that. And about three and a half years, I had paid all my bills off, and they told me to reapply for credit cards, and I got them back. And here's where all this comes into play. I thought they were just being cruel or mean or picking on me. I had a chance, my car died. I needed a new car, and we had a guy in the home group that worked for the Oldsmobile dealer in Louisville, and he had a demo that was great, and he said, I got to sell it. Everybody wants to take it home, and he said, the boss wants me to get rid of it before we have too many miles. So I went down there, and he said, how's your credit? I said, I don't know. And he checked, and he said, your credit's great, And I got the best GMAC rate and got the car. And not long after that, we had a guy in the home group that was being transferred with GE to the West Coast. And he had a beautiful condo overlooking the river. And he called and he said, do you know anybody that might be interested in this? I am. And he said, okay. He said, it's a assumable mortgage. If you want to come down to the mortgage, lender, he said, we'll take a look. And I went down there and they qualified me on the spot, and I was able to get that mortgage. And actually, the payment for that was below the rent that I was paying. It was all because of these guys that sat on me for 3.5 years and kind of got me going again financially. And I wanted to make amends to that ex-wife. We were living in the same zip code, and he looked at me and one day when I mentioned that, and he said, the best amend you can make to her is leave her the hell alone, which was not the answer that I was looking for, of course. And he said, because you're too immature in the program, and that's not an amend. And you'd just be creating fodder for more amends down the road. And he said, pray for her. And so I did. And it was interesting. 23 years later, I was at a wedding in Nashville, and I forgot to register. So I went up to the front, the country club there, and I was signing in the book, and the big door opened, and there she was. And it was the first time I had seen her in 23 years. And it was a nasty, just evil divorce. And she was there, and before she could even get her coat off, I said, let's take a walk. And we went out in the parking lot, and I was able to share, 23 years of experience of a lot of this third list, and a lot of understanding what I had done and how difficult I had made it on her. And I looked over, and as I mentioned, she's a clinical psychologist, and she's also not outwardly very emotional. And I looked over, and there was a tear running down her cheek, and she said, I forgave you a long time ago, but sure nice to hear the words. And she said, and I asked her, I said, now, I probably at this late date, there's nothing I can do for you, but is there anything I can do for you? Expecting her to say no, you know, being, you know, very gallant about it. And she said, yes, you know, there is. And she said, but I'm too, you know, emotional right now. She gave me a card, and on the back of it, she said, this is my unlisted home phone number, and when you're next time you're in Louisville, please call me, and we'll have dinner, and we'll, I would like to talk to you about something. And I told her I never go to Louisville. There's no reason to be there any, you know, anymore. And I thought the amend was over. And I went into the office. I was in the software business and, you know, vice president of sales and, you know, in the software company. And we were bidding on the census. And the boss came in that day, the Monday, and he threw a letter on my desk. And he said, there's a mandatory three-day bid meeting in Louisville. I can't go. You're going to have to go. You know, okay, you know, so I went there, and I called her, and we had dinner that second night, and I had to keep pinching myself because this lady despised me. I mean, she was furious with me, and we're sitting there, and I finished the amend, and I'll, for anybody that's in the amend process, you do it once. It's not an apology. It's a change in my behavior. So it's not, I'm so much sorrier this week than I was last week. You know, that's not what it's about. So we finished the amends, and the rest of the evening was actually pleasant. We were catching up on news of the family and all that. It'll never be anything other than just a friendly relationship, but it's so much better than the way we had left off 23 years earlier. And finally, she got to what she wanted me to do. And she said that she had remarried, and her pride and joy was her 19-year-old son, and he had been involved in a terrible DUI accident. And he was facing a court, you know, hearing, and as I mentioned earlier, the Kentucky system's even harsher than Virginia's on DWIs or DUIs. And she said that she had been to enough Al-Anon meetings to know that she was the world's worst person to talk to this kid. And would I meet with him before I left town and share my experience, strength, and hope? And I thought, of course I will. And I went over with the last day we were done at noon. I went over and met with him for about 2 or 3 hours. And there was a generational difference, but he knew who I was. And we clicked and we hit it off and everything. And I explained to him, shared my experience, strength, and hope with him. And I don't know, he got off the hook because he had a great lawyer, but he immediately took off and went to Los Angeles. But I do know this, that if he later on develops a problem and needs to get into AA wherever he is, he knows how to do it. And I had a long drive back to Virginia, and I thought, how beautiful is this? This is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the restorative power, the power of the ninth step. And I was uniquely positioned to help this kid when doctors or clergy or, you know, no one else could help him, strictly because of the experience we've had collectively with this, you know, program. 10, 11, and 12 is where I live. And I want to watch my time, but 10, 11, and 12 is where I live. I have to continuously watch for selfishness and creeping back into my life, or fear, or just self-centered behavior. But I thank God I have the 10 steps. So if I, you know, if you read the wording of the 10 step, it's not if, it's when, you know. So it tells me I'm going to mess up a lot. But I don't have to wait 10 years or 15 years. I can go immediately and take care of that. The 11th step, I've never had a problem with it. I heard a man in our home group in Louisville who was the oldest continuous sobriety in Kentucky at the time, and he was like E.F. Hutton whenever he showed up at that meeting. And occasionally he would, you know, a lot of times he wouldn't say anything, but whenever he did, it was like, you know, hush, and you listen to the guy. He was at the first meeting with Bill Wilson, the real Bill Wilson, you know, and Dr. Bob in the first meeting in Louisville, and he was an interesting guy. And when we were on the 11th step that night, and he said, I've never had a problem with it. And he said, here's why. I've never wasted a moment's time looking 2 years down the road to worry about what God's will is for me 2 years down the road. I don't get that. It doesn't come to me that way. Conversely, I always feel like I intuitively know what God's will for me is today. And he said, I think our horizon is all wrong. And he said, I don't need anybody to tell me about it. I don't need anybody to interpret it. I get it. And he said, before you think I'm saying Al, I don't always act on it. But I always feel like I sort of kind of know what it is. And he said, he believed that was the 11th step. And I try every morning. I told you those guys got me started asking for sobriety every day. 31 and a half years later, I would no more think of starting my day without asking God for another day of sobriety than I think about starting my day without a breath. It's worked perfectly every day since I've been in AA, and I'm not about to test it, you know. But what I do is I thank him at night, and then if, as the book says, and during the day, if I'm troubled or perplexed or don't know which way to go, then I'll pause and ask for help. And it works beautifully for me. The 12th step is I'm active in this program. I love this program. I need it more today than I ever have. And I try and I have a home group. I sponsor. I am sponsored. I try and chair meetings. I try and I take a meeting to the jail, you know, at the Western Virginia Regional Jail, because my sponsor, Tom I, is, you know, hammers me about the, you know, the jail committee. And I just try and do everything I can, you know, to try and carry the message, because it was this program has given me my life back, and all it asks is just a little, very little in return. And I think it's a privilege to be asked to share your experience, strength, and hope in this program. And it's a small price to pay for sobriety and getting your life back. What it's like today. I mean, I could talk an hour about this. What strikes me is it talks about, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. In other words, if I blunder through the first 11 steps imperfectly, sometimes wanting to do them, sometimes not wanting to do them, but if I do them, something changes in me. It's not something I do. I can't take credit for it. It's something that happens to me as the result of trying those first 11 steps that you're changed. One of the things that Tom wanted me to do when I first broke him in as a sponsor a few years ago is that unreasonable guy wanted me to actually go finish up my 9-step list, you know. And I had reached an impasse. I was lazy. I'd done all the hard ones, but I had a couple on it. I went and tracked down that partner and made amends to him. And I didn't know if he was still alive or, you know, I haven't seen him in a long time. But I made amends, and I told him, you know, what I was doing and what had happened. And I admitted my part in it and what I had done to him, and asked him for his forgiveness. And I said, at this late date, is there anything I can do for you? Is there anything I can do to make it right? And he's a Kentucky guy. He's a country guy, but he's pool room smart, if you know what I mean. And he kept looking at me. He said, no, something's different about you. He said, I don't know what it is, but he said, I like it. And he said, there's something different about you. And he offered to go into put me into business with him. And I'll never do it, but that's his tacit way of, you know, giving you approval. And I thanked him, and of course I'll never do it, but it's nice to, that's his way of saying you're okay. And what he was identifying, he's smart enough to know that he can spot what the effect of this program is on me or any of us if we just make a, not a great attempt, just a normal attempt at trying to do the steps with the help of a sponsor. And the appendix at the back of this book describes it as a change in values. You know, I'm talking about the spiritual experience. A change in values sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. And you'll hear old-timers use the term, I'm a recovered alcoholic. You don't hear it a lot anymore. But when I first heard it, I thought, boy, they're arrogant, recovered alcoholic. You know, what does that mean? Well, they pointed out, you know, dummy, read the appendix, you know. That's what it means. And that's essentially what's happened to me. And I can recall a lot of conversations over the years in different leads that you hear, but there are some early ones that have stuck with me. And I can remember hearing this guy. He was a professor at University of Louisville, when he was Harvard-educated, a smart guy. And he said he had pondered this thing that we're talking about, this drinking, and, you know, and knowing him, he really had pondered it, you know. But he said that that he had come to the conclusion that he thought that people stopped drinking for precisely the same reason they started, and that was to feel better. And I've thought about that, and I think he's right. All right. I heard another guy say that one of the nice things about AA is it allows me to live with unresolved problems. And nobody, if you're new in this program, you're not immune. You're not bulletproof when you get into the program. My friend Emerson G, that's no longer with us, used to talk about peaks and valleys. And I have ruined a lot of relationships and a lot of opportunities over the years by insisting on a decision today. Yes or no, up or down, tell me right now. And I induced or forced it to happen when if I just relaxed, it might have occurred or worked out a different way. I can live comfortably with unresolved problems now. I don't have to have an answer. If the answer is maybe or no tonight, great. You know, I'll let it go. I heard another guy say that one of the beautiful things about AA is that it allow you to get back to where you might have been all along if you hadn't gotten sidetracked with alcohol. And I, at that point in time that I heard that early in the program, I thought, oh, wow, it's too good to be true, if only. But I thought about it before I came up here today, and, you know, I have a beautiful home. I'm remarried. I have all the material things I'll probably ever need, blessed with my health, blessed with a lot of friends in the program. And I'm probably about where I would have been all along had I not gotten sidetracked with alcohol. So that's come true. And it talks in the vision for you about it. See to it that your relationship with the higher powers, right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And we were talking, Billy and Sam and I were talking before the meeting, you know, about Founders Day. And if anybody's not had a chance to get up to Akron, please do. You know, I try and get up there about every 5 years. And the first time I went, you see all the shrines and you see the you know, Bob's house, and you see the place where Bill and Bob met the first time at Cyberlink's gatehouse, and, you know, you see all the shrines, the Mayflower Hotel and all that. But the coolest thing is they told me they're get up in the morning on Sunday morning. They said, we're going to get up at 6, and we'll meet you in the lobby, and we're going to check out, and then we're going to go. And I said, 6? Are you nuts? You know, and they said, just get down there, you know. So I checked out, and we went over to the cemetery where Bob's grave is, and basically I'm thinking, what are we doing at the cemetery at 6:30 in the morning, you know, and we got there before dawn, and people are starting to filter in, and everybody inched in closer to the grave, and all of a sudden you hear this roar, and 2x2 Harleys start coming in, and there are 3,000 bikes coming to the cemetery, and all of a sudden you look, and a little bit before 7 a.m., there's 5,000 people in the cemetery, and then you could hear a pin drop. And all of a sudden you hear these bagpipes, and they bagpipe in the speaker with Amazing Grace. And he steps up on this little podium, and he has a little amplifier on his shirt. And he gave and delivered one of the most eloquent talks I've ever heard in my life. And there's not a dry eye in that place. I'm trying to be cool, blinking back tears. And I looked over, and there's this giant biker standing next to me crying like a baby. And that's AA. I just came back a week ago from San Antonio for the international conference, and it's the fourth one I've had a chance to go to, and they're beautiful. We were talking about it. They had the big meetings in the Alamo Dome, and this year they had an extraordinarily large crowd, and it was 62,000, drunks. And at the end of the big meeting at night, 62,000 drunks hold hands and say they are Father, and if that doesn't get a rise out of you, you don't have a pulse, it's dramatic. And if you get a chance, the next one is in Atlanta in 2015, and then they announced that the one after that is going to be in Detroit in 2020. So if you get a chance, to make plans now to go to both those. It's a wonderful experience. At the opening ceremonies, it's like the Olympics. They bring in the flags of the nation. It starts with Afghanistan and goes to Zimbabwe. And you realize pretty quickly that this is not just a Virginia program. This is a world program. And the reach and the power of this program is awesome. And I'll close with a little story that I like. I'm rereading The Spirituality of Imperfection, if anyone has ever read that. It's a neat little book, and they have little anecdotes and little stories. But there's one that I particularly like in there. It's a mom teaching her daughter how to jump rope. And she would teach her, and she would, practice a little while, and they'd clap and everything. And so she's got this friend, and she's trying to talk to him. And she said, now, honey, why don't you go along and practice, jumping rope? And after you've done that for a while, then come back. And so she turns her attention, and she's trying to engage in this conversation. Right away, the little girl comes back, and she said, are you okay? And she said, yeah. She said, I can jump rope okay, but I missed the clapping. And that's, I think, what AA does, is we clap a lot. And so anybody who's new, you'll find it's like coming home, when you come here. And so if you don't get anything else out of this lead tonight, there's a message of hope here for all of us. And I'm just grateful, and thank you, Billy, for inviting me to come up here, and thank you.